Welcome to the New Books Network.
Confounding, exhilarating, and contagious. Emotions matter, and so does applying emotional intelligence. Welcome to Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight, the podcast where emotions rule. Whatever the topic, how do hearts and minds collide? Find out with your host, a college professor turned globe-trotting EQ entrepreneur. His mission? Each week, Dan joins prominent authors in decoding how emotions drive outcomes and make people tick. Now, on to the show.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining me for the 108th episode of my podcast, Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight. The series appears here on the New Books Network, which has as its motto, sharing knowledge so people can thrive. Today's topic is an almost unified theory of songwriting and life. I'm joined by Mike Arrico. He is the author of Music, Lyrics, and Life, a field guide for the advancing songwriter. The publisher is Backbeat Books. Mike is a New York-based recording artist, writer, and lecturing professor. He's been at universities including Yale, Wesleyan, and NYU's Clive Davis Institute of Recorded Music. His opinions and insights have appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Fast Company, and elsewhere. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. So let's get started by a brief overview of the book, if you don't mind.
Absolutely. So what it is basically a result of teaching and doing songwriting for the past couple decades, and hopefully putting it all together in a way that helps in a holistic way, you know, the songwriter, the song, sure, but the songwriter who's creating the song too.
Okay.
That's a nutshell.
Sure. So I'm going to start out with some things to give, I think, the audience a sense of yourself as an artist, as a musician yourself, if you don't mind. So you mentioned one of your suggestions for your students is to create their own playlist, maybe 15 favorite songs. We won't go through 15, but do you want to give us maybe just two or three that help us get a sense of your own ambitions as a musician and songwriter?
Oh, sure. I mean, they're ambitious by definition, I guess. But for me, the classic would be Songs in the Key of Life by Stevie Wonder. I would either put Dark Side of the Moon or Animals by Pink Floyd in it. And I might also put in Moon-Shaped Pool, which is the most recent Radiohead record. I mean, I'm just pulling three just out of thin air, not knowing that you were going to ask the question. But you know, if you can drop something in between those three, that's a Bermuda Triangle I would certainly vacation in.
Yeah, and would you say there's any underlying thematics to the three you just offered us? Any additional understanding of why those three, maybe?
I think those three are coming from a place where, you know, the pop sense of things are incidental. I think they have really strong visions, and some of them are pop, as opposed to, you know, I just want to entertain. You know, I think that they're deeper listens. Certainly, the sprawling nature of something like Songs in the Key of Life will give like some of the great pop songs of all time, but also way far afield kind of stuff that shows an artist stretching, you know? So that would be the underlying for me.
Okay. Fair enough. How about favorite titles to some songs? And I know at one point in the book you mentioned rap and country music depend a lot, obviously, on the lyrics. I know one of the worst titles I ever heard, but it's kind of funny, is I Flush You from the Toilet of My Heart, or maybe it was The Bathroom of My Heart. Was a country song. But how about you? Some favorite titles?
Well, I mean, if you're good for funny for laughing titles, Get Your Tongue Out of My Mouth, I'm Kissing You Goodbye, which to me is kind of a fun thing. Whose Bed Have Your Boots Been Under? These are all things that are, you know, these are country song kind of novelty type things. But I do also really like songs that are calls to arms, you know, and it could be any type of call to arm to the dance floor or to social issues. So like something like Fight the Power or something like Fight for Your Right to Party, you know, those kind of things are amazing. I love that type of starting a title with a verb, like an action verb that's just going to grab you by the shirt and be like, you know, do this thing, whatever that thing is, you know. I think those are very powerful. And I feel like the song has started the minute you have seen the title, because you get the insistence and the ambition of the song right there from this first moment.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. The same thing with bands. I remember when I, you know, first came across long ago Talking Heads and went, they've got to be good. That's such a good name for a band.
Great name.
Yeah, versus some other band names, you go, oh my God, you should have kept dialing down and finding some other options, because that's just a loser of a name.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a little bit more deeper question, but staying with favorites. I was really intrigued at one point you mentioned that if you really have a great artist, they've got a long career, they got their early stage work, their mid stage, their late stage work, and looking at that sweep, that movement over time can really provide some learnings as to the choices they've made, the things they've come to understand about their craft. Is there someone you might take that has been instrumental for you in terms of understanding how they evolved and what that meant to them and what it could mean to you?
Well, there are the three that I mentioned just before that you could use. For me as a vocalist, the person I have used, and this is a classic rock example, but Joni Mitchell, because her vocals, her voice changes markedly across eras. And she follows her voice literally and figuratively via her songwriting. So she's a very angelic bird-like soprano in the early folk stages of her career. She liked a cigarette. Let's just say she likes a cigarette. You can hear it in the later stuff from the 90s and beyond.
True.
But you can also hear the journey that she went on, that she said she was going to go on when she was back in her bird-like phase. So like, I feel like you get this, you get a sweep and you can tell where you are in the sweep by the timbre of her voice. And her her perspective, you know, that's really exciting to me. And I feel like many pop acts, you're not going to get that, unfortunately, because like longevity is very difficult, you know. So you get the long ones, you know, like Willie Nelson, you know, or Frank Sinatra, Billie Holiday, you know. You get long. That was not quite as long, but like you still get a sense of trajectory, which is really exciting, because you can live in different eras with them.
Yeah, I think I first noticed that what you're talking about, those transitions from Billie Holiday, because in the late stuff, the range is more limited, but boy, does she get a lot out of it.
Oh, so good.
Yeah. So maybe one or two more things on the personal front. I was intrigued and enjoyed this thing about the four quadrants of trust.
Yes.
Can you take us through them maybe briefly? And where do you think your catalog of songs tend to fall? Which quadrant, or maybe it's sure. moved over time?
Well, the quadrants came from actually sort of from my dad. And my dad actually got them from the guy, W. Edwin Deming, who rearranged the Japanese auto industry after World War II. So basically, it's a management technique that I transferred to songwriting, and it has these four quadrants, because and instead of like management, we're talking about things like trust and relationships, right? Relationships are built on yeah. trust. So there are basically four ways you can go with a relationship. And so the first quadrant I use is I trust you and you are trustworthy, right? So that is a wonderful place, but it is also a place with no stakes, right? So that's like children's music is like that. Sappy music is like that. Very sentimental type places like that. It's a difficult place to get any teeth into unless you add stakes. So it's like, that's the first quadrant.
Yeah, and I like that one. I thought of maybe the Beatles' I Feel Fine, which is, you know, very bubbly and upbeat, but it's got Absolutely. A little bit of that iconic bite from John in it.
Well, that's the thing. Paul would have lived there, right? And John was undercutting, and that's the genius of the two of them. I mean, seen through the prism of this quadrant type thing, you know, I must admit it's getting better. And then John is like, it can't get no worse. Right. Yep. Like all of a sudden you're in a completely different mind space.
Okay. That's the first quadrant. Yeah, what's the next one?
That would be one. And then the second one I would say would be bottom left, if you're visualizing. And that would be, I don't trust you and you are not trustworthy, which is the mirror image, but also without any stakes. You know, this is just nihilism, right? Which there are lots of great nihilistic songs, but with a shred of hope put in as a stake, you can really get a lot of emotional power out of the most nihilistic type song. So that'd be your like sort of your bottom left. So the top.
Okay, and I would actually throw the Sex Pistols in there potentially.
Sure.
And I love your comment about stakes and whether or not there's really stakes involved, because to me at the end of, was it God Save the Queen, where he says, England's dreaming, she has no future, and he belts out, no future, no future for you. And finally at the end of the song, which I think was what makes it, he says, no future for me. So he's not just condescending. It's, you know, this all pervasive feeling. So he's all in on the feeling.
Yeah, absolutely. And without a hope for a better place, that song has no meaning, right? Like he aspires to a better England.
Yes.
But he's not seeing it. So there's your stakes, I think. There's your hope. And even just the energy itself is hope.
True.
So, okay, so now we're in the top right corner, quadrant, which is, I trust you, and you are not trustworthy, right? So there, that's most of pop music, right? It's also all the blues, right? You done me wrong, I can't believe it, you know, where were you last night, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think a lot of Lucinda Williams songs go there, and she's one of my absolute favorites.
Sure. So much pop music. So many of my students are coming out with like breakup songs, and the reason for the breakup is always you were terrible in some fashion. You know, you were a horrible person, and here's a song. Here's the song that is the tattoo you will never forget. But the thing about that quadrant that I like to make clear is that it is an honorable place to be, because you are the person trusting, right? And that is the half that you can control that will get you to this top left quadrant, which is, I trust you and you are trustworthy, right? Hopefully that's where a relationship will ultimately end, right? Or resolve. So there's that place, and it is honorable. Now the bottom right quadrant is the final one, which is, I don't trust you and you are trustworthy, which is a mistake you can never take back, right? And that is very tortured and a terrible place to live and a terrible place to write, you know, although incredible music comes from that. It's very, very broken, and the stakes.
Yeah, I think of Blood on the Tracks by Dylan there, for instance.
The stakes are existential, because it's about time and it's about the irretrievable, right? So in the present tense, it's like, I want to trust you, I can't get out of my own way. And in the past, it's, I had it all and I lost it. I'm an idiot, you know? That's a tough place, and it's a tough song. So what I ask is, I ask my students is to just look at their songs across their catalog and see which ones they're writing in and whether or not one or another is one that can be visited or changed, right, in revision. Or maybe you have one that's just too hopeful and needs a John Lennon line that will change it, or a Sex Pistols line that'll change it. And so it's a revision tool, but it's also sort of an overarching sort of catalog tool, because when you're making an album or something, or an EP or whatever it is, you want to look across to see whether or not you're banging on the same note over and over and over again. And hopefully what you want is a varied palette of emotion for your listener, because that's what they're living.
Yeah, no, I agree. And if you're pulling together an album, it's nice to have it have its own internal coherence, but also have just enough variety,
right?
Or maybe a lot of variety to make it work.
Yeah.
So let's switch over to maybe a bit on the craft of doing things. I really love this stuff you said about how you work the downbeat and the melodies. And I'd never made the kind of separations that you had before. I thought it was just a delightful part of the book. Can you share that with listeners?
I believe the part you're talking about is called melodic math. And we talk about, these are a lot of these things are revision ideas, but they're really ideas about contrast, no matter what you're doing, right? Contrast is always good. Chiaroscuro, right? So in the case of sections and songwriting sections, watching where you land on the downbeat of a section can actually change your sense of where the section goes and what the section feels like relative to what came before it. So what I mean is, really conversational verses might happen, might begin after the downbeat, but a urgent chorus of some sort might come two or three beats before the downbeat of the chorus to really get you, you know, into it and to really sort of anticipate. The anticipation of the one gives us a sense of urgency, which is now the important part is not one or the other, but a mix of ideas, of contrasting ideas, so that you have, so you're not banging on the same note again, you know? So each one of these things are sort of revision ideas. And the first thing I check when a student comes to me with a song and they're like, you know what, this is just not working for me. Something's wrong. I'm bored. I don't know why. Is it me? Is it my life? It's like, well, let's just take a look at the sections first before you get existential. Are they all landing on the one and starting that way? Is there a way we can anticipate or shift a melody so that something unexpected is happening between sections? So that's sort of what I meant. And that is an ancient sort of idea that stems from the concept of music as science, you know, that music is actually science and we are actually counting without knowing that we're counting. So there is an internal clock going on at all times. So that's what we're playing with. And melodic math is actually just is addressing the counting and the math that is intrinsic in songs.
Sure. And I like the idea of just a little bit of a shift, a little bit of a surprise, because it leads me into another thing that's, right, I think, related, where you're talking about brain teasers versus, yes, brain embarrassers and taking us out there a ways, but not so far. So I don't want to step on your toes. You talk about it a bit and I might add something in.
Mm-hmm. Brain teasers and brain embarrassers. Just before we move away from the melodic math thing, you were talked about Bob Dylan. I'm like trying to think of a good example, a great example. How does it feel? You know what I mean? Now that anticipates the one, but the fact that he started before gives us even more of a slingshot into that course. Anyway, so back now. Okay, brain teasers and brain embarrassers. This is also like sort of an idea that we are science. We're numbers and we're ones and zeros, you know, or we're not even that. We're more elemental even than that. And I spoke to an astronomer in the book to sort of get scientific basis of these things. But we count and we have a culture that enjoys four, you know, the number four or the 4/4 time signature or 4-bar phrases or 16-bar solos, 32-bar song forms, things that are divisible in this way. That is sort of Western numerical sort of understanding of songwriting. So what we do is we try to play with this, play with our expectation, play with the expectation of numbers, and play with the expectation of where they're going to land and how we can solve them, because we're very vain. Like, our brains are incredibly vain. So if I can figure out a puzzle, I think I'm a genius, right?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
The brain likes pattern matching. If you can show that you're awesome at it, then you feel good about yourself.
It's tremendous. Yes. But we are so vain that we also will take the puzzle itself into consideration. Like, if it's too easy a puzzle, we are annoyed, right? We are bored, and we turn it off. And of course, if it's too difficult, we are angered, we are embarrassed, we are shamed, we are all of this, and we think that we're dumb, whatever. So what we do as songwriters is we play with that. And my charge to my students is, where do you want to land on the line of solvability, right? So do you want to be simple and easy to understand? Do you want to do Happy Birthday, Jack and Jill Went Up the Hill, et cetera, et cetera? Or do you want to be like one of the bands I discussed, which is Radiohead, where, I mean, I went to a show, a Radiohead show. My wife is dancing, and she asked me, what's the problem with this song? And I said, there's nothing wrong with the song. I don't think that they really want you to be dancing, to be honest. I think they want you to be detached and somehow floating in a dystopian metaverse. And they kind of say as much in their lyrics. What they've done is try to make it less solvable. And dancing is in itself a solution to a rhythm. It's a response and it's a collaboration with rhythm. And I think Radiohead would much rather you feel a little bit detached. You know, that's their aesthetic. So what I tell my students is, where do you fit on this timeline, this line of solvability? So,
you know, I like the Radiohead aesthetic. I remember going to a Cowboy Junkies concert, and at one point she says, you know, so we've been told that someone is here on their honeymoon. He said, you know, we haven't ever recorded maybe more than one or two happy songs ever. So are you sure we're the right pick for your honeymoon? I really liked that moment. So the brain teasers and brain embarrassers made me think of something. I don't know if you've ever heard of Wundt's curve. You know what that is?
Maybe not by a name.
Yeah. Yeah, so Wundt was the co-founder of modern psychology, along with Freud. And in trying to figure out what appealed to us, he kind of played that same line, but he made it just a little bit more, I guess, complicated. He said that really the sweet spot is if you made it simple and novel, or familiar and complex. In other words, there's some way that you have a toehold in, which is the simple or the familiar, but then you add the sizzle to the steak by having the novel or the complex.
Yes.
And if you just do simple, familiar, boring as can be, if you do complex and new, now you're into brain embarrasser, because it's just too much for people. There's no toehold and way in. So I thought you might enjoy that.
Yes, absolutely. I've also heard it expressed as meeting expectation in an unexpected way.
So yeah.
It's a little bit like,
Yeah, I like that too, because so often I've done a lot of work in working with ad agencies, and they have to deal with their clients who may be very creative and may not be, and it's the battle between the company wanting the simple and familiar, yep, totally safe, and the ad agency often wanting the complex and new, and then they battle.
Yep.
And so it goes. Another favorite part of the book for me was the stuff about mission songs, and I love that term. Can you explain to listeners what it means? And you already mentioned Fight the Power, which I think is an excellent example, but maybe one or two others you'd like to go into.
Sure. Well, these are songs that hopefully make the writer understandable to the listener, right? So we know that Bruce Springsteen comes from New Jersey because he told us 100,000 times, right?
And, yes, and so he did.
He had a mission, and he had a universe and an environment that he wanted to introduce us to. And he gave us his manifesto. And he is not the only one by a long shot, obviously. Eminem is from Detroit. There's pretty much no way not to know that. So songs like that give us their invites into who the writer actually is, who the artist is, and there are lots of different ways that I prompt my students to get into, so that they can tell the listener how they want to be understood. Right. The classic example I give in the book is "I Want to Rock and Roll All Night and Party Every Day." Because Kiss, the band that wrote it, was visually arresting and musically very confusing because no one understood what was going on. And their A&R person asked them to go home and tell listeners what they're about, right? So that their mission, as Paul Stanley, who I interviewed, told me, he's like, they went home and they're like, well, what do you want? And the answer was, I want to rock and roll all night and party every day. So hence the song, hence the hit, but hence the way to understand a very strange looking band, you know? So there are lots of ways, and there are very contemporary ways as well. Obviously, I remember the first time I heard, I heard Royals by Lorde, and her mission, which is we'll never be royals to me. I understood we, right? The we is the group into which I belong. I mean, I am not the demographic necessarily, but I will never be royals either, right? And I understood a little bit about her sense of class and what she felt was important, and what she felt how she felt a kinship to her audience. So that to me was a great one. Geography is a great one, is a great type of mission, a great way of understanding an artist. The one I always use in class is Kacey Musgraves, who her first album, and it's first songs that usually do this, but her first album is called Same Trailer, Different Park. And to me, that is, that metaphorical place is one that I can inhabit, even though I am not from East Texas, as she is, and I'm not a country person per se. I live in New York City. But also there are personalities that come through in mission songs. Billie Eilish's first song is Bad Guy, you know? I'm the bad guy, right? Is not far afield from, you know, Johnny Cash saying, I'm the man in black.
Black, yes.
Right? So, but basically, now I understand Billy for now and for all time. Right?
Yeah, you can locate her, you can identify, etc.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I can decide whether or not I'm going to get on board, right? So there, it's really an invite, and it's like a put up or shut up kind of moment, right? Are you with me or are you not? Getting in the milk toasty kind of middle zone is not a good place.
Yeah, the squishy middle. Yes.
Right.
So last question before we wrap up here. Obviously, there is music, and then there is the music industry. And one aspect of that, which kind of gets into emotional intelligence, is how to navigate co-writing and collaboration and royalty splits and all of that. I mean, I saw a documentary not long ago about the band, and I always wondered why they faltered so quickly, because I love their early stuff. And if I gather correctly from the documentary, it's really that Robbie Robertson, you know, started hoarding the song credits, and Levon Helms was mortally offended because he thought they had been collaborative enterprises. Any advice that you give students that you've observed from your own career just on navigating the music industry and maybe even the co-writing angle in particular?
Yes, this is a critical part, unfortunately, of songwriting, because it has to do with whether or not you're going to continue songwriting or collaborating, because this is something that can actually tear apart a band or the band or Creedence Clearwater Revival or thousands of other bands that direction. I interviewed a bunch of writers in the book with a bunch of different ways to split the pie. From Shane McAnally, who was like, number of people in the room equals number of pieces of pie. And that's it, you know? But I would say if there's an overarching idea, it's very simple. It's that it's a people industry, so don't be a jerk, right?
Yeah.
If it's a 50-50 thing with two people, don't get into a fight about being 60-40 on a songwriting type thing, because what's going to happen is you're never going to write again. And then now you're 0-0. that's yes. Your next song and all songs forever else, you know, in the future. So not being a jerk is really the way to do this. And there is a little bit of swallowing of bitter pills that occur. I also mentioned a great example of someone saying no. It was Dolly Parton actually saying no to Elvis Presley on I Will Always Love You. He fell in love. Dolly Parton wrote the song. It was on the album Jolene. It became a huge hit. Elvis loved it, wanted to cover it, and wanted the songwriting credit for it, the publishing. She had a very difficult night, she said. She cried all night and said no. And Elvis never recorded it, but Whitney Houston did. And her line of classic Dolly Parton line is, after I got that check, I had enough money to buy Graceland. Basically. So saying no is also a possibility.
Sure. Although on behalf of Elvis, I would say it's probably Tom Parker, Colonel Tom Parker, who was more responsible for being greedy and pushing that quote unquote offer to Dolly.
Certainly. Yes. Certainly.
Yeah.
But he never covered it.
Yeah. So, well, thank you, Mike. We could go on and on with this. I really love the book. I love the conversation. This has been Mike Arrico. This has been episode 108. He is the author of Music, Lyrics, and Life, A Field Guide for the Advancing Songwriter. If you enjoyed today's show, please give it a rating or review on iTunes. You can find other episodes by going to the New Books Network, typing in Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight, and all of the 107 previous episodes will emerge. Finally, I'd like to conclude every episode with an epigram. In this case, I took one from, I believe, a singer-songwriter you enjoy, Tom Waits, who said, "I like beautiful melodies telling me terrible things." Until next time, take care and be well.